You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where our borders are still open. I'm your host, Justin M. Lesneski, and I just want to touch base with something I talked about last episode, because there was a news story this week that hasn't gotten any coverage. Well, it got a minimal amount of coverage that I think should be getting more coverage, simply if the culture was being consistent, if people were being consistent. So last week, one of the things I talked about is how I think the greater threat to our culture right now is Marxism rather than white supremacy. And I backed that up by saying, with all the places I've lived, all the places I've been, I've seen more people being openly Marxist and forwarding an openly Marxist agenda than forwarding an openly white supremacist agenda. And then this week, of course, in Virginia, some dude tried to run over protesters with his pickup truck. I say try because maybe one of the reasons the story's not getting coverage is because only one guy on a bicycle was minorly injured, so there were no real ramifications of this event, of this attack. But this person who did this was identified by the police, because apparently he has openly said it before, as a KKK leader. So my question is, why is this story, if people really think white supremacy is such a big threat, why is this story not being talked about? This should be a story where they say, look at this fucked up shit that's going on. Look at how fucked up this guy is. He tried to run his pickup truck into people. And that's 100% correct. It's 100% true. He shouldn't have fucking done that. He's a fucking racist. He's scum. Why aren't they talking about it and saying, thank God nothing happened. Look, this proves our point. These people are fighting back, but they're not. And reflect on why they wouldn't. And hopefully the rest of this episode helps you think about why they wouldn't be talking about those things. So let's get on with it. Let's introduce our first post-Daniel episode of the show ever. Now I am the only consistent host. It's kind of scary in a way, kind of weird to think about. Joining me this trip from Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. Yeah, I guess I'm inconsistent. Is that the implication?
Okay. twist on words. You're fucking with my words. What are we on Twitter right now? No, I've been here from the beginning. Daniel had been here from the beginning, and then we had Elliot, we had James, now we have you.
And don't forget the doctor.
You've been consistent since you started. Oh yeah, we had the doctor in the lost season, but I don't know if people really count that season. That's impressive. Okay, maybe your consistency is good enough that you know about the first season where we had multiple people rotating as the doctor.
Yeah, I listened. So things are going okay. Some craziness in the news this week, and I think I just want things to get back to normal soon. Whatever normal means. I actually had some friends over.
We went the other direction.
Yeah, to friends over to play some video games, and we tried to have a normal, normal evening, and it was good. It was special.
Listen, buddy, listen, check your privilege. Normal was never ideal, okay? So yeah, watch it.
I know. Normal talk. My privilege is showing. Oh, God, what am I going to do?
I like him already. I was going to say the same thing. You're being racist. By not being anti-racist and playing video games, you're being racist. How dare you?
How dare I think individual lives matter and be against a political Marxist movement?
Unless you're playing that communist video game Tonight We Riot, then
there's a video game trailer that's going to be on Trailer Takedown in the next couple weeks that is peak woke, and I can't wait for us to add it in. It didn't make it this week, but it will make it next week.
Well, William, we went the other extreme. We were complaining there was no news. Now there's too much news.
Yeah,
so let's find that happy medium. Although I do like individual lives matters as an answer to all lives matter or Black Lives Matter. I like individual lives matter. I like that. I'm gonna marinate on that. But first, I'm gonna bring in our other host, as you've already heard, from Los Angeles, which I'm sorry to hear that. Comedian Kirk Wilcox.
Knock, knock, open up the door. It's real. What's going on? It's a pleasure to be here, guys.
I didn't know we had doors in the Mid-Side.
Yeah.
We're without borders.
That's right.
We're like
Chaz. We're an autonomous zone here. We have no borders, no police. We have armed thugs, namely me. I think I'm the only one armed. So we're just like Chaz.
I actually filed a little over a week ago to get my permit to own firearms. That's how it is in California. You have to like fill out a permission slip and send it to the government with $20, and then they decide whether or not you're allowed to own a gun.
Yeah, it's crazy. I on my block there happens to be a gun store, and after the riot, the first day of riots, the line. Of course, properly socially distanced was around the block for the next couple of days of people going in and signing up and getting their paperwork.
Oh, I believe
that sort of stuff. And I had mentioned on Twitter, I said, wow, some Californians are realizing that it should be as easy to vote as it is to purchase a gun. And I got some surprised responses on Twitter. People thinking that was, I guess, a bad thought, but yeah, it's definitely easier to vote here than it is to purchase a gun, and that both seem like those constitutional rights things. Same people we don't want to vote, we don't want to own guns, as far as I understand it.
Yeah, people will stand outside of a Ralph's and ask if you're registered to vote, and then they'll help you register to vote. But like to own a firearm, like I had to like look it up. First, I went to a sporting goods store to see if I could purchase a firearm. They said, no, you have to like fill out this background check and it could take up to 10 days. And so I had to go home and look that up. And you needed like two forms of identification if you didn't have the federal limits apply identification, and then you had to like get it notarized and all this crap. So this notion that it's as easy to register to vote is such a myth.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Let's have people standing outside Ralph's handing out guns instead. I'm for that.
Or like in that Michael Moore movie, it's like, if you open a new bank account, then they just give you a gun.
I think in some Ralph's they do pass out guns, but that might be other areas.
I'm just amazed it's only $20. You were like $20. I was like, wow, you're getting off easy in California. It starts at like $200. All right, let's do it. Let's head into all this crazy news we have in the news without Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
Before we get started with the news here, I would just like to remind you about our Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/themidside or themidside.com/patreon. And if you like the content we're coming out with, you can toss us however much money you want per episode, maybe a couple bucks, maybe a cent, whatever it is. We picked up a couple Patreon supporters this past week, so thank you. Apparently, you appreciate our battle for individualism. Not that I want to necessarily say the show is an advocacy show. I just hope you're entertained by this and you're willing to support us if you're entertained. And speaking of entertaining, I think the first story we have here is more entertaining than anything for me, although there is a dark, seedy underbelly to it. William, I think you're the one who actually put me onto this story.
Oh, baby.
MLS, which is the first part of the joke when you say MLS, fired a player, or they parted ways amicably, but remember when that happened to Zack Snyder, what that really was, with their midfielder, Alexander Katai. He's actually European, even though his last name would sound Asian. Katai.
Yeah, it reminds me of Kaientai from the WWE Attitude Era.
Wow, that is a deep pull, and that is a great pull.
Yeah, cut off Val Venus's penis, if you remember.
Well,
or they tried
like that,
to.
Nothing like that happened here, although you would understand if they fired him for that. But no, instead they fired him for, get this, his wife posting, and her wife said, here's the T, because her name is T. His wife T posted twice on her Instagram Apparently, one, she supposedly called for the protesters to be killed, but they don't give proof of that. And the second is a looter hold. She posted a picture of a looter holding a shoebox with the caption, "Black Nikes Matter." Now, I want to be clear. Neither of these posts are funny. These are why I hate Instagram.
Well, Black Nikes Matter? At least it's an attempt at being humorous.
It's an attempt at being humorous. But it's like she probably heard it from someone else and was like, oh, I'm going to post that. I'm funny, especially because she lives in L.A. She was like, oh, this is what the L.A. people are doing. What really bothers me here, though, William, what really, really, really bothers me is how collectivistic this is. The idea that he loses his job because his wife is stupid. Now, you can question him. You go, why are you married to her? Why would you marry someone who would make posts like that?
But we should fire people for poor marriage decisions. I can't wait.
Well, isn't that what they did?
I think it's more insidious. What they did was, this is a blood crime, right? Like, this is some medieval shit. I think I said that on Twitter when I found this story. Holding you as the... You're the head of your household, and so someone in your household commits a crime, and so you are being held responsible. This is like medieval shit, right?
Like, and this is what they do in North Korea. Like, if you were to defect, then they'd punish your family members.
It's absolutely bizarre, and yeah, I mean, I also have to mention, Justin, the media coverage of this was you got to wonder. Like, if this was some kind of hit job, because these posts are bad, like, whatever. But they also characterize them as her talking about BLM when the pictures she's posted, and I posted them to the channel here, are about the riots, not the protests. And I thought we were supposed to be, you know, I thought we were all supposed to be drawing that distinction between the quote-unquote peaceful protests and the quote-unquote riots, right? And she's clearly showing a picture of a riot and saying things that maybe you find offensive. But every news story talked like she was talking about BLM. And it was written to fit the narrative well, not to fit the facts well.
I think you're raising a very interesting point here. And I don't think it's necessarily targeted at T herself. I don't think they were like, man, we have an axe to grind with T. But when we're talking about this Game of Thrones style shit, Kirk, is this showing how deep the Black Lives Matter group with the name? I don't want to say, you know, every person who's saying Black Lives Matter is part of the Marxist leftist group. But is this showing how ingrained that group is in the culture and in the mainstream media, that they're pushing, using a story like this to push this narrative?
It's hard to tell what is really going on with the whole Black Lives Matter thing, because like you said, I think there's like three different parts to this whole thing. There's the slogan, there's the movement, and then there's the organization. And I think most people use the slogan, you know, pretty innocently to say, yeah, Black Lives Matter, which they do. And they think that when they say it, they're pushing for good stuff like police reform and anti-racism and justice reform, fighting back against injustice and police brutality. But then when you like look at the movement, there's, you know, it's kind of like the libertarian movement when you think of it. Like there are some good people in the libertarian movement. It's mostly like economics nerds and people like John Stossel and Penn Jillette who are pretty good. But then when you look at, when you see like the anarchists and the conspiracy crazies, and there are like some theocratic and racist elements coming into the libertarian movement, especially with those goofs over at Liberty Hangout, it's like, ooh, I don't know. I'm not sure about this whole libertarian movement. And you kind of see it with Black Lives Matter. There are some good voices, but then like, yeah, there are some clear, it's clear that some people, some Marxists and some hardcore leftists are trying to use this movement to put some really bad ideas in the culture. And you can see this clearly as of late when people talk about stuff like police abolition and prison abolition, which I'm sure we're going to get into later because that's what the people in the Chaz are calling for.
Yeah, and I think that when William is talking about all this stuff, that's what I think of. I think all of us can agree with maybe two out of the three of what you just said. We can all certainly agree with Black Lives Matter as a slogan. As individualists, and I feel comfortable speaking we when, you know, I'm talking about individualists, we say Black Lives Matter because, what did you say, William? Individual lives matter, and they are a subset of individual lives. So I think logically okay with that. And I know I personally don't have a problem with the movement against police brutality. I think we've talked about extensively on the show, William, about the militarization of the police and how just in general the authoritarianism of the state has made these police officers become the way they are. And yeah. I would say it's the third thing we have the problem with, right, William? It's the way this group, this Marxist group that's been around for a while, and if you go to their website, you see they're using words like comrades are controlling this narrative.
And I went to and I was looking at the different chapters last night, and like I think some especially the main website, they're good at hiding their intentions better than others. But like the Washington D.C. Black Lives Matter website, they're explicit that they want to get rid of capitalism.
Yeah, it's a huge package deal, right? Like it's the same thing I've been having that Twitter conversation about intersectionalism. The problem is that there's a package deal and an anti-concept that's kind of destroying clear thinking here. We talked about this last show. I was just as outraged as all these folks are today when we had the Daniel Schaefer thing, right, out in Arizona. Where the guy was executed on the floor of a hotel hallway, right?
Right, and the police were out of control, right? Giving different commands, making it impossible for him to follow, scaring the shit out of him. So Basically, they basically made it so there was no way that could end without him getting killed.
Exactly. But somehow we're not supposed to read any intersectionalness into that, right? There's no special moral weight given to it, right? But when... You know, because of the media coverage of all the stuff that's going on now, we're supposed to give some tremendous media some weight to it. But then what does it really mean when we're saying, are we only going to focus on police brutality against blacks? Is that really what we want to do? Or do we want to get to the root of the problem and say, this is a problem, the policing is a problem? And because of intersectionality, because of the Marxist roots of BLM, they're going in this direction where they're taking that to its absurd conclusion, where it's, yes, it is about blacks, and oh, it's also about destroying capitalism because capitalism is anti-black somehow, and oh, it's about overthrowing the government and creating a anarchist paradise called the Chaz and all these other things. I mean, you just have to look at the demands of the Chaz state to understand what their actual goal is. And
we'll get there. We'll get to those demands. So put a pin in that right. For a second. But what I want to do is bring this back to the beginning of the story, because the root and the way we ended up here from where we started, which is we remembered LA Galaxy spilled the tea. We ended up here because of collectivism. And rather than, you know, talking to the guy at work, right? Katai, talking to him at work and saying, Katai, well, what's the deal with your wife? Like, that's really weird. Like that, I didn't find that funny. And then he could go home and talk to her and say, you know, you're making things a little difficult with my team, and it's hurting our cohesion and hurting my work environment. And then if she really loved him, she would assess whether posts like that were worthwhile, if ideas she held were worthwhile, if they supported her marriage and supported her life. But instead, you throw all of them out. And you hurt both of them because you're judging them collectivistically, like you said, like a Game of Thrones blood-style family. It becomes the Red Wedding.
Yeah, it just goes to show you that... I think Dave Rubin has brought this up before. You don't apologize. And what he means when he says that is you don't apologize to people who are seeking your destruction, right? Even if you've done something wrong, if their goal is to destroy you, apologizing is not going to do anything. It's actually going to feed them. They're going to think that they can manipulate you through guilt. Normally, when you apologize to someone, it's because you want to make amends and continue a relationship with them. But if someone is literally out trying to destroy you, get you fired, whatever, like apologizing to them does nothing. It doesn't help you, and it actually hurts you. And this is an example
point.
Of that.
Right, it's a perfect example, and the next story we see another example of that because of the point you just made, which is so great. when you are apologizing, you're apologizing as an individual, but they're not seeing you as an individual because they have a bloodlust where they're just out to punish anyone and everyone for what they see as injustice.
That fits the identity narrative, exactly. That fits
right.
the identity
And we
narrative.
See that perfectly in the next story.
Didn't this happen? Something similar happened, I think, a year or 2 years ago. Like some NASCAR driver lost a sponsorship or got kicked out because of something his dad said like 2 or 3 decades ago. Said some racist. I think he said the N-word like 2 or 3 decades ago, and then the driver.
I think we covered
like,
that story. I'll have to look in the notes.
Probably. It sounds like a mid-side story. But, I mean, that happens more frequently than we would like to talk about. And that's what we bring up in the on the show. So if we look at the next story, which should make us all very uncomfortable, and there's a lot of very uncomfortable elements to this, and I'm going to start one place and bring us another place. But first, before I bring it to the second place, I want to talk about the just surface level of the story or the first angle to look at the story from. And it's and I don't remember the guy's name and everything. It doesn't matter to me as much because I don't want to dox him as well. But if you all remember when everything started happening and we started really going down the rabbit hole of, hey, we're going to show people who don't support Black Lives Matter and are being racist. We're going to put videos of them up. And there was that old guy attacking the teenage girls in the park. He had on a bike helmet and sunglasses, and he was in decent shape. So he looked like any generic white guy who was in decent shape and was above the age of 45.
Are you saying all white people look the same?
I'm saying all white people wearing helmets, having sunglasses on, who are male and are in decent shape look the same, yes. Especially in grainy, pixelated video.
And wearing and a, he was and a tight skin bike outfit.
Right. That anyone could buy. So he was harassing these girls, and of course everyone was mad at him, as they should be. Like, dude, just leave the teenage girls alone. Like, if you're above the age of 45 and you don't have a reason to be interacting with teenage girls, stop. All right, just as a general rule of thumb, stop. Whatever it is, even if you're going to say, hey, have a nice day, or hey, here's an ice cream cone, stop. Even that's going to be grooming or some shit. Just stop. Okay? But what happened here is, online people are like, help us identify this person. So then, of course, what happened? The Twitter mob identified and doxed the wrong person. It eventually came out that it was someone else. But as the writer of the story pointed out very well, and I appreciated this by the writer, the tweets and stories that showed the wrong person got more attention by an exponential amount than the ones that exonerated him and said, oops, sorry, we made a mistake. So it's like they called the guy a racist and then they exonerated him. But no one saw the exoneration. The problem I have with this, William, is, and this goes to the Chaz thing again, and that's why I put the Chaz story last, but we'll see this culminating. We already have a process for these things. We have a process for figuring out who did it. We have people that we pay. Our tax dollars go to paying to these people.
We've abolished them.
It's infuriating.
We're ceding to the mob. The mob is the arbiter of truth.
I was thinking that, like, the whole irony of this, you know, when we're talking about cases like George Floyd, I think more so with Ahmaud Arbery, is like, I think, like, the big lesson is those guys didn't get their day in court. And they'll never get their day in court. And it's really tragic that they won't. And that we shouldn't assume guilt amongst people who might be suspects of a crime or some wrongdoing. Yet when it comes to this guy who didn't do anything wrong, everyone assumes he's the guy that did something wrong in this viral video. Where is his justice? Why aren't we giving him a benefit of doubt or a presumption of innocence?
Right. And it's a great point because we're replacing that with whatever the mob thinks is correct. And that's the other thing I wanted to talk about is the inverse of what you just said, Kirk. The idea that not only are they presuming some people guilty, they're presuming other people innocent. And we see this with two stories that are just breaking over the weekend. Well, one was last week and I knew Twitter was going to pick it up eventually. And one's just breaking over the weekend. The first is Robert Fuller, who was found hanged in a tree in Palmdale, and it was ruled a suicide. And then, of course, Twitter picked it up, and because he's black, they assumed that he was lynched. So they're trying to get the FBI in and invested in and reinvestigated and open up again, because now Palmdale is full of KKK and full of white supremacists. So when I say he's guilty, what I mean by that is they're presuming because he's black, he's innocent. And what I mean by that is he couldn't have possibly hurt himself because he's black. There's no way a black, that's the argument they're making. No black man would actually hang himself in a tree. That doesn't make any sense. Why would somebody do that? And then in the other one, too, the Rashard Brooks, that people are assuming he's innocent. So what happened in that case is you have a guy who's parked in a drive-through line and not moving, and he's asleep. So I want to be very clear. This is private property, right? Wendy's is private property. So Wendy's is like, hey, this guy's affecting our business, and they call the police. The police show up, they move him out of the way, they pull him out of the car, and they do a sobriety test. And he is not sober. I guess he's drunk. I don't know. Maybe he had alcohol. I don't know what the exact substance was. I'm assuming if they did the test, it had to have been for alcohol, because I don't know of any test in the moment that can test for any other drugs. But the point is, he's drunk. So then they try and arrest him. And he starts resisting arrest. He grabs the stun gun. He runs away from them. He tries to shoot him with the stun gun. And he ends up shot. So what do they do? What does the mob do? They protest. And they burn down the Wendy's. Now, I'm not defending the cops. I'm not saying they should have killed the guy. I mean, if you can't stop a drunk guy from getting away, then maybe you're not fit to be a cop. But to say this guy, like, I saw a tweet that somebody was like, he was literally just sleeping.
Yeah.
He was sleeping. He's innocent. How dare you just kill someone who's sleeping? Breonna Taylor was sleeping. Now, what happened to Breonna Taylor is fucking terrible. But to compare the two, simply because of their race, is not fair, Kirk. He's not sleeping. He's sleeping in a car in the Wendy's drive-thru line. That's private fucking property. They're trying to do business.
Yeah. And he, you know, allegedly he was well above the legal limit for alcohol. And that is, you know, when you are drunk driving, you are a threat to other drivers on the road and other people who might be proximate to the road. That is a serious crime that should not be treated lightly. Again, I'm not saying he deserved to get shot over this, but it's not like it was some minor crime like George Floyd, who, you know, he may have tried to spend some counterfeit money, and I don't know if he even needed to be arrested for that. That's a whole other debate. Or Eric Garner, who was selling loose cigarettes. Like, that's such a minor crime that you don't really deserve to get apprehended. But, like, yeah, if you're drunk behind the wheel, and especially if you, yeah, and on top of that, you're, you know, disrupting someone else's business like Wendy's, like, that's not like a light crime that should be treated lightly.
Well, I guess Wendy's doesn't have to worry about their business being disrupted anymore. I mean, I know that Wendy's corporate had done something like 50 million or 500 million, some obscene amount of money donated to BLM related charities, but
that was 500,000.
Yeah, but no amount is going to assuage the mob, right? There's no pre-forgiveness. There's no atonement. It's somehow Wendy's fault. And I think I also, didn't the police chief in Atlanta resign over this too?
Yeah.
Yeah. And her name is Erica Shields. Does anyone know? I think maybe. Oh, keep talking, William. But I'm looking up who she is. Because I have a suspicion here.
Yeah. Well, getting back to the fake identity thing, the mobbing idea.
It's a white woman, but still, I thought it was a woman, though. But it's still a woman. Like, yeah, like
intersectionally, like
it doesn't matter. Look at the Seattle Police Department. The chief of police is a black woman, and so like it doesn't matter when it's her. Like, they still treat her like she's part of this. The problem with police.
Yeah, I think the problem is I keep falling into this trap where I'm trying to figure out the twisted logic of the
hierarchy.
The hierarchy, and it's just it's like a Rubik's cube, right? Like, you don't know at any moment the mob can decide which one is the correct one. that we're supposed to listen to. And it, I, you know, it's really more about what's going to fit the narrative that that folks
Correct.
Want to see. Rather
and
than
the narrative in their head goes back to the Marxism of the there are oppressed people and there are oppressors. So that's the real way to figure it out, William, is just look at the situation and in the situation, who would be the oppressed and who would be the oppressor? Well, Wendy's is at fault because they're a business and capitalism oppresses people. Therefore, we have to burn them to the ground. That's all it is. It's not this fucking guy is being a douchebag and he's violating the social contract by being fucking drunk in his car and driving. First of all, fuck you for that. And then you just go in the drive-thru and pass out because you're so fucking drunk and you're disrupting every other, not just Wendy's doing their business. But what about all the other fucking people who want to go in that drive-thru and have to fucking put up with him and drive around him?
I don't know, Justin. I just want to make sure he was wearing a mask.
That's... He was not in the video wearing a mask.
Well, then the seventh ring of hell for him, I guess.
Did you you had a point it sounded like you wanted to make about the guy who got doxxed for biking?
Oh, it's a, I've already forgotten it now. We've traveled so far on this journey.
Well, we always travel far, and let's travel a little farther here. And let's go all the way to, well, I guess we're in Atlanta, so we're not going that far north. Let's go a little further north to Nashville, Tennessee. And let's talk about Lady Antebellum. Have you ever heard of them?
I have.
I have not. I figured there was a chance one of you hadn't heard of them. Yeah, they're actually a pretty popular country triumvirate. I don't know. What do you say for three? You don't say duo, whatever. There's three of them. It's a woman,
trio.
Two guys. Trio. Thank you. I couldn't think of the word.
Triumvirate.
Appreciate that.
It sounds very... You know, Roman power, like a ruling over Nashville.
Can we call them the Triforce of Nashville? They're gonna go fight Gannon.
Wouldn't go that far.
Okay. Well, anyway, they decided in racial solidarity with Black Lives Matter to change their name from Lady Antebellum to just shorten it to Lady A, because apparently their name, which is in reference to, they said, the architecture of the South before the Civil War, is racist because it makes people think of the Civil War. So my question about that is, before we go deeper into this article, does that mean we should ban Captain America Civil War? Can nobody ever watch it again because it makes us think of the Civil War? Same thing Gone with the Wind is taken off of HBO Max.
Well, isn't it in a way worse than the Civil War? Because it's about the period before and leading up to the Civil War, which was, you know, worse than, I mean, maybe not worse than the Civil War, but like, that's why the Civil War was fought, was to end that society in the South and end slavery and try to give equal rights to people who did not have equal rights in the South.
Does that mean we throw out all the architecture and everything that was in the antebellum period? Because that's what they're saying. That entire argument they're saying is, well, America was founded pre that. So everything that happened before the Civil War needs to be gotten rid of because it's all founded on slavery.
It's also weird because you're changing your name to Lady A, which is just an abbreviation of Antebellum. So you're not even really changing your name that much.
Right, because everyone's going to know what the A stands for, right?
What if she changed her name to Lady A is A?
Then we'd be in a really weird position because I'm not really a big fan of Lady Antebellum. And neither, surprisingly, William, this is what you're saying, neither of the social justice warriors. They're mad at her. Or them. It's a group. It's not a woman. It's the lead singer. I think there's two singers. But anyway, they're mad because, get this, William, there was already a blues singer who used that name. Black female.
So cultural appropriation. Name.
So now, yeah, not only that, but now they're taking marketing and notoriety from this woman. The mob is never satisfied. This is what you were saying, William. They'll never be satisfied.
Well, I thought we were supposed to eat the rich, and I'm assuming Lady Antebellum is, or Lady A, or the artist formerly known as Lady Antebellum, is rich. So maybe they're just following the Marxist eat the rich algorithm.
Yeah, I read the story you sent me from Rolling Stone, and it does mention that Lady Antebellum never heard of the blues singer Lady A, which I think is, you know, understandable. I've never heard of either of these, you know, musical acts. It kind of reminds me of this comic that someone sent me years ago where this guy, he writes a joke, a new joke that he thinks is funny. And then like the last frame of the comic is the guy sitting in a room full of TV monitors all around him. And he says to himself, all right, now it's time to watch everything that's ever happened to make sure this joke hasn't been done before. Sometimes you just don't know. You can't really blame someone for ignorance. And I think the story even mentioned that this is probably going to be challenged in court over trademark infringement, which it probably should be. But this isn't like a new phenomenon. Prince had to deal with this. And I'm actually surprised this isn't a bigger controversy in the age of the internet where everyone has a Twitch stream, everyone has a YouTube channel, everyone has a podcast, everyone has their different type of avatars and whatnot. I'm surprised this isn't a bigger deal of people infringing on, you know, trademarks and personas and whatnot.
I mean, we've been battling Welcome to the Beehive for what, 6 years now, Justin?
Yeah, and go on and search. We've been battling them. There was Welcome to Night Vale we were battling as well, which I think they were part of Seattle, so they might be in the autonomous zone now.
Yeah, our battle will have to pause for a while. They're
but
out
go
of our
on Twitter and search Midside, William. And there are people who use Midside as their Twitter handle now, and there's this like whole community built around. It's apparently in music or in sound audio recording now. There's something called a Midside Out filter or something. And there's even a person who constantly talks about the movie Inside Out by Pixar as Midside Out. So that'll show up a lot. And now, it's mainly us on that when you search Midside, but can we sue them? So, I mean, Kirk, your point is really well taken that this is typical. But they're mad because, as William was saying with the Rubik's Cube, this week the Rubik's Cube is, fuck you. This is a black woman's name, and you say you're doing it to help black people. So because there was an unintended consequence, Rolling Stone is mad at them, and the social justice warriors are mad at them. It's crazy.
Well, from what I've seen, Rolling Stone is run by, you know, lefties anyway, so this shouldn't be surprising.
Oh, yeah, they're definitely. And I guess when you're talking about lefties running things and not being surprised, then you have to talk about the insanity that is the reality show called the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone in Seattle.
Speaking of which, sorry to interrupt, apparently they're already trying to change their name to, I think, CHOP, C-H-O-P. The occupation zone or something like that. I forget exactly what but I saw that the other day that they're trying to take down all the Chaz signs and rename their little country.
Their branding. Was there a black jazz band named Chaz in the past or something?
Maybe.
Yeah, they realized they fucked up and they didn't have good social media branding with their name. They're like, all right, who did this? Which one of you? You're fucking out. Grab that guy out with a chokehold. But I think it's the most fucking entertaining thing I've seen in the longest time. Like, just how fucking terrible it is. But the thing that's really interesting, and there'll be a link here on the podcast, the podcast episode site, so go check that out, is they published a list on Medium. It's called The Demands of the Collective Black Voices at Free Capitol Hill to the Government of Seattle, Washington. The first thing I want to say is, while I have seen videos of black people there, it seems like it's mainly white people in the autonomous zone. So it's interesting to me. It's the demands of the collective black voices. But that's the least interesting point here. What's more interesting is this list of what they want to change. So we have like, given the historical moment, we'll begin with our demands pertaining to the justice system. That we demand abolition of the police department and court system. And then they give a list of how. And on this list, it's we demand. It's all over and over again, we demand. We demand reparations for victims of police brutality in a form to be determined. Okay? So even if people were willing to accept that, they'd be like, so we can't do anything about that right now? You just want, like, in the future that to happen? We demand decriminalization of the acts of protest and amnesty for protesters generally. What? They don't even define what an act of protest is. We demand that the city of Seattle and the state government release any prisoner currently serving time for marijuana. Well, now we're talking about the war on drugs here. When did we get to that?
Let me say I am in total favor of that proposal. I think everyone who's in on, you know, drug usage, drug possession crime should be released immediately.
Yeah, and I also am, and I think William, are as well.
And at least it's tangentially related to the police. But some of the other ones aren't.
Yeah. We also have economic demands that must be addressed, as what William's talking about. We demand the de-gentrification of Seattle, starting with rent control. What?
De-gentrification? That's an old callback for you.
We demand the restoration of city funding for arts and culture. That's related to the police. We demand free culture, free college. We demand that between now and the abolition of the police, be prohibited from performing homeless sweeps. What?
On its face, when they say we got to abolish police and prisons, and then also they want all these new economic regulations and all these new wealth redistribution schemes, and it's like, how do you expect to enforce these regulations and property taxes or whatever taxes will be required to fund these wealth redistribution schemes, these welfare programs, if you don't have police or prisons as a means of punishing people who don't pay their taxes or don't live up to rent control or whatever it is?
Yeah, I don't know, because they also don't want any evictions. So that's gonna be interesting, because if you can't evict anyone and there's no police, who's going to pay rent ever?
Right, so that's why they want rent control. The rent control is zero rent. There, the rent is controlled.
Well, housing is a right, according to them. So. The funny thing is, Justin... So they did all this, and I of course go deep and go into the deep and dark web, as they say, over in Hacker 4chan. They were basically generating flyers to attract the homeless to Chaz, and while they were doing that, it happened already. The homeless took all the food, and they demanded more vegan meatless. Protein or whatever, and like soy and oats and stuff, and then they started growing potatoes on top of cardboard, and it's crazy. They have segregated gardens. They have segregated gardens.
Well, that okay, great point there. Hold on, I'm gonna stop you there. I like what you're saying, but there's one thing when you're talking about segregation. One of their demands: we demand the hospitals and care facilities of Seattle employ Black doctors and nurses specifically to help care for Black patients.
Yikes!
Didn't we?
Yikes! We fought a war to stop that.
I thought wasn't the whole civil rights movement about no separate but equal?
They also we demand a retrial of all people of color currently serving prison sentence for violent crime by a jury of their peers in their community. So it sounds like they want race-based jury selection as well.
Yeah, that one threw me off a little, because if they were already tried by the court, weren't they tried by a jury of their peers already? I guess, maybe. I think that's what you just said is probably the part I was missing. They mean their racial peers, not just their geographic peers, right?
Well, they don't just mean racial, because we see how there was the video of the guy, the Black man going in with the flag, the American flag, and he was getting attacked too. So it's not just their racial, it's their ideological. And that's what's so absurd about everything you were just saying, William. First of all, the reality of this situation is not what they're portraying it. They brought the homeless in because none of them are staying there at night. They go there during the day and they hang out. And then you know what they do? They go home and they sleep and they eat in their normal places, in their normal places they live. So they need the homeless there so it can stay occupied. Because if it's not occupied, what'll happen? It'll just get cleaned up when they're not there. That's why they want no homeless sweeps while this is going on, so they can stay there. And then the idea that they can't even make food themselves, it's called the autonomous zone, and they can't make food themselves. That's why I think this is the greatest entertainment ever. It's exposing Marxism for what it is.
Yeah.
As a leech.
Everyone keeps glorifying it like, they're all sharing snacks and watching movies and having a good time. What's wrong? And it's like, well, they clearly you know, hate the system, hate society, yet they still need to rely on whatever elements of capitalism are left to get food, to wear the clothes they're wearing. All these people are wearing clothes made by large corporations. They all have cell phones. They're relying on electricity. I mean, they don't have their own power plant in this Chaz zone. They're sleeping in tents that were made by large corporations. So this idea that, like, oh, well, they're self-sustaining. No, they're not.
You know, it's funny. We called out, as a society, we called out the craziness that was Waco, right? There were kids there, and, you know, there was the whole Waco response and all this other stuff, right? And people broke that down, and then and we treated the Occupy Wall Street very different than those kinds of religious cults incidents that's happened in the past. But I would love to see someone compare and contrast this. This feels like a religious cult situation. It feels like another Occupy Wall Street or another, you know, Waco style cult, right? Like, these people have these self-sustaining beliefs and feel like they should be independent, right? There's also parallels with the whole sovereign citizen people, right? Like, they feel like if they put up, pallets, that they've made themselves an independent nation, right? It's just the symbolism of it, that the fact that
William,
they say
aren't there
it makes
parallels?
It so.
Aren't there parallels with the Sharon Tate murder?
Maybe.
I'm blanking on the name. The guy from that.
Who Charles Manson.
Manson, right? Isn't this what? And I don't know how no one's turned on Quentin Tarantino yet. Isn't this what Tarantino was doing with his fable, his fairy tale in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, exposing the evils of this? I mean, remember when Brad Pitt's character went into where the hippies were living? Wasn't that Chaz? Wasn't that the same thing? What's the difference?
I really don't think.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too, because when you look at the coverage of, like, the whole hippie movement of the 60s and Woodstock, it's often, oh, it's just peace and love and everyone coming together and getting along and it was all good and fine. And but then, like, I feel like that whole movement came to a screeching halt. I think it was already dying by the time the Manson murders happened. But when those Manson murders happened, like, the whole hippie movement just died. It seemed like they all went to universities and got jobs, or they just went and did something else. They went to disco clubs or whatever. Like, it wasn't cool to be a hippie anymore, because then suddenly they were associated with the Manson family. But I don't think the Chaz have reached anywhere near that point yet. But I guess but you do see, like, some of the rhetoric on Twitter, like, when I don't know if this is a fair comparison, but, you know, when I would, like, read about, you know, protests and riots, like, people would say, oh, like, when they were planning a protest in Van Nuys, I saw people on Van saying, hey, don't smash up the businesses in Van Nuys. Don't do that to Van Nuys, because the business, those are small businesses and they're not going to be able to recover. You know, and I saw people saying, go take that to the hills. Go take that to, you know, the nicer areas of Los Angeles. And it's like, well, that's what they went to the hills and they were, you know, seeking people out. But I guess the difference here is, like, oh, well, this is social justice, whereas the Manson family was motivated by racism. Like, Charles Manson clearly wanted a race war. So they would say, oh, we're not the same. You know, that guy was a nutty racist. We're actually fighting for something good, social justice and egalitarianism.
Well, and that's the point. And that goes back to what I always say when I say individualism is the answer. You've really gotten to the core of something that shows there is no difference between what they were doing, because it's the same fires of collectivism, and it's the same idea of we have to fight back, because in the Marxist worldview of oppressor versus oppressed, we're the oppressed, so we have a right to do that. And the other connection I'm seeing here, and you guys can check me against reality if I'm wrong, I'm seeing a lot of youth, and that's why I make the connection to the hippie movement. I mean, I made a tweet in response to someone making fun of Chaz or something, and this 18-year-old girl from the area who knew people in there started replying to me, and she started telling me, you know, like, this is an experiment, and she started saying, like, all of these rudimentary philosophical and political things to me. And I get it. Like, youth needs to learn, right? I'm an educator. I get that. But why does it seem like as a society, William, we're throwing everything out? Why, when I look at Chaz, I see people who are like, you know what, we need to prove for ourselves that socialism and communism don't work, and we need to prove for ourselves that we can live without capitalism and without this oppressive white supremacist society. Well, that's what it looks like to me. Am I crazy that it seems like we're just saying we need to retry everything again?
Yeah, there's sort of a, do you think it's like a little Rousseauian in that way, right? They're trying to I keep going back to the gardens, right? It's like these people have clearly never planted a garden or farmed anything, right? Like just looking at it, you can just tell. And there's some sort of a bit of Rousseauian sort of return to our noble savage roots, right? I mean, we can see the anarchism in there, but it is a little different than that, right? It's this, well, we're just going to throw away the system, and then it should just naturally work after that, right?
Right, and that's where I'm seeing really the youth come in, exactly what you just said. We've never done a garden, but we're just going to grow our own food. Like, isn't that something you would ask as a parent? Now, I'm not a parent, but I said, I'm an educator, and as I'm getting older, I'm seeing interactions like this where it's like, oh, I don't need you. I'll just grow my own food. And you would ask, well, have you ever grown your own food? No. And then you would just go, okay, good luck with that. Because you know they're going to come back later and say, hey, can I have $20 for dinner? And isn't that what they did with the sign? And it's the same thing. Yeah. That seems like it's happening philosophically, Kirk. It seems like philosophically they're just going to end up back where we are now, but it's for some reason they need to see it for themselves. Maybe it is a failure of the education system.
Oh, you think this is a result of the failure of America's education system?
I was just an idea I'm throwing out.
Well,
there.
I don't know if you saw it. Did you see the video I put up this week where I talked about America's educational system and how it's heavily influenced by John Dewey, who thought that Aristotle's logic was old and outdated and was overdue for a change, and thought that the law of identity was trivial and all of this other nonsense. He thought that kids learn by... He thought that the acquirement of knowledge was such a selfish affair or such an individual affair that it naturally leads to selfishness, and he sees no social benefit or gain or motive from the mere acquirement of knowledge.
Yeah, I watched a video, and yeah, that was my key takeaway, is that that the influence of we should trust the mob versus trusting your mind. That was really my takeaway from your video. And that's exactly what you're seeing here, right? Like, we're supposed to just trust the mob, or the Chaz folks are just supposed to trust the mob to take care of them. They're going to achieve this as a collective, whatever that means, right? And not as individuals like facing reality.
Yeah, I see a lot of people on the right who like oppose this. They say, oh, it's all Marxist indoctrination and propaganda in the schools and in the universities, which to an extent, that's true. But when you look at John Dewey, it's 1,000 times worse, because he wasn't like, he didn't really have a political, I mean, he had some political motives, but it wasn't like, he wasn't trying to like sell kids on Marxism. He was trying to destroy the way they think, and now we have a bunch of people who don't know how to think, and so they're way more susceptible to bad ideas like Marxism when they get to college.
Well, and they're way more susceptible to that, and as well as the emotionalism that comes with it, which is really what's fueling all of this. When I look at everything we've talked about today, all the stories we've talked about today, it looks like it's just the emotionalism that's fueling it.
I feel like another story that you can compare to this is, maybe you can compare the Ammon Bundy, the 2016, there were two different Bundy related standoffs, but the 2016 one where they took over some federal, what was it called? I can't remember what it was called, but it was some place in Oregon where Ammon Bundy, he got a bunch of militia guys and they took over this building in Oregon. And they were doing it in the name of justice because these two guys, these two ranchers were in jail and then they were supposed to be released, but something happened where they got sentenced to longer prison sentences. So then Ammon Bundy tried to get, you know, fight for justice. And even the 2014 standoff, they were fighting against big government and saying this is unfair. But you look at the media treatment of the Bundys, which I'm no defender of the Bundys, by the way, I want to make that clear. And then you see their treatment of the Chaz and it's like, oh, well, the Chaz are just fine. You know, what's the big deal? And I see people trying to blame the city of Seattle, which I do think there's a lot to blame. They say, oh, well, the police, they left the precinct. So what can you do? You know, these people are just trying to take care of their community while the police left them. And the mayor is clearly appeasing the people in the Chaz. But it's like, well, you didn't really have this case with the Ammon Bundy, and they were claiming they were fighting for justice and unfair prison sentences and all that crap.
But they had privilege.
Oh, yeah, true.
Yeah, I think it's inarguable that the media is participating in this false narrative of, you know, the inability to think and all of these things that are driving this. And when you're talking about the two things you're talking about and other news stories we can compare it about, or just stories we can compare it about, it makes me think of everything that happened with J.K. Rowling over this past week. So why don't we talk about that in The Hopeful Romantic with JML. To syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need a rerun to better cast the next series of events in the air timeline lapse. My made-for-TV type was written off in the last season when I wasn't focused on. As always, if you would like to continue this conversation with us during the week, you can do so in our Discord channel. You just go to themidside.com or themidside.com/podcast, click on any of the episode links, and you can join the Discord that way. We've been getting a lot more traction, William, lately, haven't we?
Discord's been crazy. There's been a lot of great conversations, a lot of great articles being posted, a lot of great discussions. I really appreciate everyone in this crazy time of isolation, and not just in the physical sense, thanks to COVID, but in the political sense, thanks to this collectivism orgy that's going on right now. Nice to chat with some midsiders to clear our head and engage our brains for once.
Right, and to find other people, as you were just alluding to, who support individualism. Because one thing I've learned over all of this, William, is just how few people actually stand for and explicitly understand what individualism is. I thought that the reason it was difficult to get traction was that there were just so many voices out there that people didn't know who to listen to. But I think it's really that people are just guided by their emotions. So if you're not just guided by your emotions, come join the conversation and find other people like you and tell some friends and they can join in too. And we could talk about things like the Harry Potter franchise. And I know Midsider Michael out there is a big Harry Potter fan. I didn't know that, but he's going to come visit and we're going to go to Universal because he was like, hey, why don't we do that? Because I'm into Harry Potter. And I was like, I didn't know that. You need to go there. But the Harry Potter franchise is something that's really interesting to me because it's a little bit younger than me, only, you know, by a few years, but it was so formative on a generation of kids, and the way they've responded to J.K. Rowling since then has moved in such a direction that it's so interesting. Like, I don't know if you remember originally when J.K. Rowling was like, oh, by the way, Dumbledore was gay. It's nowhere in the story. And I guess she's done that a lot since, where she's said a lot of things that aren't in the story, so they're not canon, but they're in her canon, so people debate about that. And they've actually moved on to talking about what she says in Twitter, and they went an extra step forward this week, where comicbook.com says the Harry Potter franchise needs to move on from J.K. Rowling. I guess she said some stuff, and I know, William, you are more familiar with these kind of topics, which make her a trans-exclusionary radical feminist, a TERF, as they call it.
Yeah,
I remember Milo Yiannopoulos back in the day.
Yeah, she believes that biological sex exists, so we must terminate her with extreme vengeance.
Yeah, and I saw her tweet about that, where she used even their language, right? She was like, if we get rid of biological sex, and I'm paraphrasing, if we get rid of biological sex, we are going to be destroying or eliminating or ignoring the experiences of so many people. So how can we do that if all we're doing is silencing people? And I was like, she sounds like that's social justice rhetoric. She sounds like she agrees with them. But they're trying to get rid of her. And they're taking it to the extreme where they're saying the franchise doesn't need her anymore. Harry Potter doesn't need her anymore. Harry Potter doesn't need the person who has written everything about Harry Potter. She has written every book. She was involved in all of the movies. Everything that it is because of her. We're moving into this new stage, William, where everything is the ownership of the audience. How
is this toxic fandom, Justin? Is this toxic fandom? I remember calling for Disney Star Wars to be consistent with my many rants on Star Trek Discovery. If you're playing the drinking game, I just mentioned STD. We talked about how every criticism was called toxic fandom, but at no point.
Well, come on, dude. I was in the Snyder Cut movement, and the Snyder Cut gets announced, and they said it was a win for toxic fandom.
Yeah. Well, this is actual toxic fandom, right? Like, we should take away what you've created because you don't I don't even know if it's you don't understand it. It's because you are bad, right?
Right.
It's because you are bad.
It's even worse than you don't understand, right? The argument against The Last Jedi was Rian Johnson doesn't understand Star Wars and it contradicts Luke Skywalker and all of these things. That's not even my argument against that movie. My argument against that movie is it's just social justice propaganda. And he didn't try to make a good story. He just tried to make a propaganda piece. But that's a different discussion. But that was their argument against that, right? That he didn't understand Star Wars and Disney doesn't understand Star Wars. They're destroying what the core of Star Wars is. And the argument with the Snyder Cut was his movie was never released. The artist made his movie and we want to see it, so you should release it. Now they're using the inverse argument. Oh, the art doesn't belong to the artist anymore. What she created doesn't belong to her.
I would say that the law argues otherwise. her bank account argues otherwise.
Yeah.
Well, reality certainly does, but what does it say? What does it say that we're to the point as a society that somebody would seriously, comicbook.com, would seriously cover this, and people would seriously argue that Harry Potter doesn't need J.K. Rowling anymore. That it doesn't belong to her, it belongs to the audience. What does that say that we're saying these things seriously?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I think this is a consequence of the way that folks engage with art and literature. And I'll take a short journey. So, I'm a fan of Luke Travers and his Touching the Art series. And one of the things that you do when you're reading the art in the method that he advocates is you do not look at the title or the author placard that's next to the art, right? You engage with the art directly, right? You look at the painting, you look at the sculpture, and you start looking at it in different ways, and you use your mind to understand it. And then allow your emotional connection to form based on that, right? But that's not how we're taught literature, Justin, right? I mean, we're supposed to read it as an intersection of the identity of the author and their, the societal conditions that created this piece, right? And ignore the actual things that are written, right? The actual words on the page.
Yeah, and it's more fundamental than that. And I had never heard what you said, Luke Travers said before, and maybe you're not expressing it as well as he could, because I take slight issue with what you said. And what it is school puts the emotional standpoint first, right? So there's two things they teach that are detrimental, and the you're talking about the second one, which is detrimental. But the even more detrimental one is the first question they ask you in school after you finish reading is, well, what do you feel about that? How did that make you feel? You should always, and this is my slight disagreement with Luke Travers, is you should always seek to understand first. So using your knowledge of what exists that you're looking at and observing, if we're talking visual art, we're talking audio, we're talking reading, what is it first, and then have an emotional reaction to it? Because you can't properly respond to something emotionally unless you understand it first. Now, we see that you can unhealthily...
That's exactly what Luke says,
right,
by the way.
Yeah. Right. That's why I said you probably didn't say it as eloquently as he could.
Exactly.
We've seen people, though, William, we've seen them not respond to the world in a healthy emotional manner, right? They think they're perceiving something and they're not. I mean, we're even talking about in the news stories today, right? The proper emotional reaction to what happened in Atlanta is fuck that guy and fuck the cops, right? That guy should have been fucking killed, but also that guy's a drunk dumbass, right? I look at that entire situation and I go, why are we judging our society by a bunch of fucking stupid people, terrible people?
Yeah. Emphasis on what you said, fuck those cops, right? Not right. Fuck all cops, right?
Right. Well, and notice I didn't say fuck all black people. I said fuck that guy, right? I didn't even mention his race.
Exactly.
I didn't even mention his race. That's something I even haven't brought up in all of this. When I see someone, my first thought isn't, oh, he's black, right? Like, I see minorities all the time, and like, my first thought will be like, Jesus, that guy's out of shape, or Jesus, that guy's jacked, or wow, he's walking kind of funny. Like, it's always an observation about like how they're carrying themselves or what they're doing, and their race is always secondary to me. And that's what I mean when you have to understand first with art. Art teaches you how to use your perceptual and conceptual faculties to understand reality. And we're coming at everything backwards. Because the first thing is emotionally, and then the second thing is what you're saying, William. Everything has to be contextualized in the understanding of the author and the understanding of the author's historical context. Look, one of the things about Zack Snyder I talk about is, you know, him saying, I have an Ayn Rand aesthetic, and he wants to make the Fountainhead. And there are clues outside his art that he is, you know, shares our perspectives. That he's objective-ish, as we like to say. But regardless of all that, we got there, William, from watching his movies and saying, hey, look at these ideas in there. Like when you look at Sucker Punch and it says you have all the weapons you need, now fight. And the whole movie is about using your mind and believing in your efficacy to be able to overcome and not just simply being a victim. Or Man of Steel, the symbol of the House of El means hope, and it stands with that hope comes with the belief that every person can be a force for good. Or in Batman versus Superman, where it says, "Be their hero, or you know, or be none of it. Be whatever you want. You never owed this world a thing, and this is my world. You are my world." There's plenty of things in there internally to the art, but you have to understand it first and then react. But what happens is everyone who's looking at everything backwards is going in with their emotional approach, and they're seeing what they want in it, and that makes them have completely different readings of whatever the art is. And then it gets to the point that their reading is completely different from who the artist is and what the artist was going for. And you end up with, oh, well, we don't need J.K. Rowling anymore.
Yeah, well, we also don't need Mark Twain anymore. He's white and said the N-word, so we should get rid of his books.
Well, it's interesting, and I think this is really telling, because I think a similar issue is happening with another artist, Ice Cube. I don't know if you guys have been paying attention to Ice Cube lately, who is someone whose music I appreciate, especially the song It Was a Good Day. Lately, he's been tweeting a praise for Minister Louis Farrakhan, who is known for his blatant, disgusting anti-Semitism, and he's been posting like anti-Semitic memes, Ice Cube has, and defending Minister Farrakhan and whatnot. And I think he just tweeted something. He tweeted something just now.
So we're going to fire Ice Cube's wife, right?
Apparently not. I haven't seen the coverage about Ice Cube the way J.K. Rowling's getting covered, but there is a part of me, I gotta be honest, I like some of Ice Cube's music. I really like Straight Outta Compton, the movie. But now if It Was a Good Day, if that comes on the radio, like, that's a song that I usually enjoy, usually puts me in a good mood, but now there's a part of me that's going to think, oh man, this was made by a guy who defends anti-Semitism.
Yeah, and I think there's something a bit different from that. I can understand that on an emotional level, and it's tough to separate that way, right? We saw that whole discussion with the whole Michael Jackson pedophilia thing. Like,
oh,
we
yeah.
completely wiped away Michael Jackson from our culture, even though he was hugely influential in the 80s. I mean, to the point that, ironically, he even was in a movie, Captain EO, in Disneyland, Disney World, and he was a pedophile. Like, so I get that. But would we then say that Ice Cube's music doesn't belong to him anymore? Right? Would we then say, NWA has grown past needing Ice Cube anymore? Would we say Michael Jackson's music doesn't belong to Michael Jackson? Go ahead.
Absolutely not. I wouldn't say that. No.
Right. And that's my problem, and that's what scares me here, is the idea of the collective ownership of art, that the audience defines the meaning, not the piece of art, right? The artist defines the meaning while creating the art, but once the art exists, that is an independent thing in reality that must be understood on its own terms, not with what the audience wants to imprint on it, and not with what the audience may say afterwards. That's why Rowley saying Dumbledore is gay is pointless, because he does nothing related to sexuality, gay or straight, within the movies. So she can say that all she wants, but internal to the movies and the books, there's nothing you can interpret to get to that conclusion. And the quality of the art is defined by the artist's ability to communicate his or her intent with that final product. If you see the final product and an artist is like, oh man, I was going for happiness, and it makes you sad, and you can prove why it makes you sad, and it's objectively that, well, then they failed as an artist. And we've taken the power of, very literally, the power of the artist away by saying it doesn't matter what the artist says it is and what the artist is going for. It just matters that it belongs to the mob. And that's terrifying to me. It's terrifying.
I remember years ago, I don't know if you guys know who Bill Simmons is. He's a popular sports guy, and he hosts a popular podcast I've listened to for over a decade. I remember he had Chuck Klosterman on, who's a music journalist, famous music journalist. And I remember Chuck Klosterman suggested that we nationalize Star Wars. This was before, I think it was right after Force Awakens. But he's like, yeah, everyone loves Star Wars, but it can even be better, because when you go to see Star Wars, like, you know, the money that you're paying for the tickets, that's going to go to fund the better good of the United States. And it's going to make people even more involved socially in Star Wars. And I'm like, it's not your property to nationalize, buddy.
Yeah, that sounds like it's right out of Out the Shrugged. Let's just nationalize the Star Wars industry. Wow. Well, that sums it up. That sums it up pretty well. Let's move on then. This week I didn't, because there's only one trailer. But generally, the trailers for Trailer Takedown are up on the website. But there's only one trailer this week, so just go Google Bill and Ted Face the Music. You can watch the trailer now. You can watch it after we talk about it. You can do it in between, whatever you want.
Trailer Takedown. Final trailer.
Interesting, William. Can it be the final trailer if it's the only trailer?
Uh-huh.
Is it both the first and final trailer at the same time?
It's the alpha and the omega.
You could have done first trailer, then final trailer right in a row.
Way to step on it, Justin.
No! It's like he's still here. Bill and Ted Face the Music is the long-awaited end of the trilogy. I don't know if they're going to keep making movies. Third movie in the Bill and Ted trilogy. There's Bill and Ted Excellent Adventure, Bill and Ted Bogus Journey. For me personally, these are movies I watched a lot growing up. They were always on TV. One of the things that makes me sad about the current culture and, you know, the moving away from broadcast television is, and we've talked about this before with like the breaking down of the gatekeepers and everything and the value of that, is there aren't going to be those movies that are constantly on TV all the time. Or they may be on TV, but not as many people have TV and it's their only source of entertainment, so they don't just turn it on. They're like, eh, well, I guess I'll put Bill and Ted on again. This is one of those, these two movies were always on, especially Bogus Journey. I always remember the devil, William Sadler in Bogus Journey. And they're movies that I loved growing up, and I thought they gave Keanu Reeves sort of his bad reputation where people are like, he can't act. He always comes across as stupid. It's like, so you're judging him by his acting in the movies that got him started. And he's finally had a career renaissance. And there's, I'm saying that because there's an irony to what I'm about to say. So I value these highly, and I've been waiting for this movie for a long time, which is a long reason, a big reason I wanted to bring this trailer on, put it on the show. And also because we haven't had a trailer to talk about forever. So it's nice to have a trailer to talk about. But this trailer in specific, on its own, not with the nostalgia, right? Because we have to understand it on its own, as we were just talking about, not the nostalgia. Because nostalgia-wise, I'm like, yeah, cool, Bill and Ted. Ah, it doesn't matter what this movie is. I'm going to love it anyway, because it's Bill and Ted. But looking at this trailer, it's about a minute and a half. In it, Bill and Ted are confronted by the Council of the Future, and they're like, you never wrote the song that cured the world. And they try and use time travel to figure it out. And it was just generic to me. Like, it looked generic. The entire trailer had all the same feel to it, the same color palette. And I have a very bluish memory of it in my mind, like, for some reason. And the thing that stuck out to me the most in this trailer is Keanu Reeves didn't seem to be acting like Ted. He honestly, if I thought Keanu Reeves was going to do a Clint Eastwood impersonation, that's what it would look like. He just looked like an annoyed old man. Whereas, I can't remember the other actor's name right now off the top of my head, but the guy playing Bill, he nailed it. He was playing the same character again. Now, granted, that's all he's done, right? I don't think he's really been in anything else, so he's been waiting for this moment since the last movie. So maybe it's Keanu is a victim of his own success, but that was the number one thing that stood out to me. I was like, he doesn't seem like Ted anymore. And it was also, this is the oldest he's looked. So I didn't know if maybe they were doing something with the makeup to make him look older, because Keanu Reeves usually doesn't look that old. But yeah, I would call this movie not Bill and Ted Face the Music, but Keanu Reeves impersonates Clint Eastwood. Now, that said, if I didn't know what this was and I didn't love the other two, it would be a tackle. But as I said, this franchise is so important to me in my youth that I have to see this movie just to see it. Sort of like I was in a similar place with the Aladdin live action movie. I was going to see it no matter what. So this is a very tentative hug.
Hug?
William?
So this was not a large part of my youth, so I didn't have any nostalgia glasses to put on for it. And you know my crazy tastes when it comes to comedy. I don't know. There was no laughs. So when there's no laughs and it's a comedy trailer, I think I back out and go for a better day. So I'm going to tackle it.
Tackle.
Kirk?
Well, gentlemen, you might want to get your stakes and mallets and 2x4s ready, because I have a feeling I'm about to get crucified here, but I have not really seen the Bill and Ted movies. I think I saw half of one when I was sleeping over at a friend's house when I was a kid, and I didn't get it, and I don't know if I was supposed to get it, but I was never really interested. So I will say, I know we're supposed to judge the trailer independently, but watching it, it did make me curious because I didn't really get it. I don't really understand what's going on. I'm like, maybe I need to watch the other two movies. Maybe they're worth watching if they're making this sequel, you know, 3 decades or whatever later. It did make me curious enough to go watch the other two movies to see maybe I'm missing out on something. But I do agree with Justin on Keanu Reeves. He does seem like he's kind of like a guy. The thing I got from it is he looks like a guy. They look like people who haven't grown up, even though they're pretty old. And I was wondering, maybe that's an aspect of this movie. Maybe they're going to kind of mock millennial slash Gen X culture and mock these generations of adults who are old but have not grown up. Maybe that might be a funny satirical take that we might get from this movie. We haven't seen it from the trailer, but I thought maybe from what I've seen from the trailer, that might be something we can expect from the movie. But yeah, I would say, I guess my take would be Tackle, but I am curious now to see the other two movies. So maybe it's both. I don't know.
Tackle.
So Justin, one quick hit from you. Did you watch Artemis on Disney Plus yet?
No.
It might be the candidate for worst movie of the year.
Huh. That's supposed to entice me to watch it? When did Frozen 2 come out? Because I watched that and I was fucking terrible. what I was going to say is, can we just get like three quick hugs for watching the original movies?
Hug.
Okay, we'll take one. Hug. But yeah, definitely. There we go.
Hug.
I don't have the soundboard. I thought someone was going to play the sound for me.
He was playing the soundboard. But definitely, if you have not seen the original two movies, go back and watch the original two movies. And I think your analysis, Kirk, could be correct. I could see them going in that direction about the whole having not grown up thing. It's just that they're supposed to be like Valley surfer dudes. And like maybe that's part of the problem, is maybe Keanu Reeves was playing it more grown up than they haven't grown up. Because you don't want to see Bill and Ted not be Bill and Ted. Like an annoying old Ted sounds annoying and old. Like, all right. So it's been a long trip. We've been a lot of places. We visited the Chaz. We were in Atlanta. We were in many places. What did we learn? William, you go first.
All right. I learned that the mid-side belongs to the audience. And if you don't like Justin's take, you just, I guess, take the mid-side from us? Question mark?
How does that work?
I don't know. Kirk, right. What did you learn?
I learned that Bill and Ted are probably movies worth watching if you haven't seen them yet. So I probably will check them out eventually.
Justin, what did you learn?
I learned that apparently I need to be scared for my life because you all are going to come for the show and take it from me. All right, I want to thank Kirk for coming on the show. It was great having you this episode. We're going to have a lot of different voices coming up here over the next few weeks, couple months, see what everyone's like, see what's out there. Kirk, for you, do you have anywhere you want to plug, any projects, where can people find you, that kind of stuff?
Well, first off, I'd like to say thanks for having me on today. It was a lot of fun. Hope the audience enjoyed it. And if you want more from me, follow me on Twitter at Kirk Wilcox. Look me up on YouTube, where I try to post consistently, at least weekly, Kirk Wilcox. I also do Twitch, although I haven't Twitched in a while, but Kirkomania on Twitch. So check me out if you haven't yet.
Definitely do that. Give him a follow. I enjoy his Twitter content. It's pretty funny. I want to thank all you Midsiders out there for listening. Obviously, we create the show, but it would just be me talking into the corner of my closet if you didn't listen to it. So thank you for not having me as crazy as the people in Chaz by listening. Thank you to Liberty.me for syndicating us. We love our libertarian listeners. Know oftentimes that objectivists will have problems with libertarians. I do not necessarily have those problems, so thank you. Love you. You can always check out also themidside.com/store. I really need to get some new shirts going on. So if anyone has any ideas for some shirts to make, you can throw them my way and maybe I'll find some time to work on them in between writing my novel, which I'm almost finished with. Again, there's Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/themidside, themidside.com/Patreon, then you can help us keep the light's on. Right now, the light is on in my closet. Without you, it would not be on. So please, if you like the show, consider donating even a dollar. And finally, and most importantly, William, if there's one thing I learned from Daniel, this is the most important thing to say, William, is tell a friend. So can you tell a friend this week, William?
Absolutely.
And Kirk, you're going to tell all your friends on Twitter by tweeting the episode out, right?
I don't have any friends. Are you kidding me?
Your 900 followers, right?
I'll tweet it out. I'm definitely tweeting this out.
All right. And you Midsiders, just tell one friend. As we were saying earlier with Discord, there's not that many people out there that actually conceptualize and support individualism. So if you know somebody else who would appreciate that perspective, send them to the Midside. As for you, this concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin M. Lesneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have an autonomous zone.
I got nothing for the secret at the end of the episode. I don't know if you do, William.
Nope. This is a long episode, dude.